This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland court has dropped all charges against Occupy Portland activist Mike Bluehair Smith. Protest groups plan a day of action in Salem over the Columbia River crossing, and the Eugene City Council allows tents on city property after protests. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. I'm Brian Pritchett. In a Portland courthouse today, all charges were dropped against an Occupy Portland activist arrested in February at a protest against corporate influence in politics. The day of protest was held on February 29th and was called the F-29 Day of Action. The target of the protest was a group of corporations associated with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes model legislation that is then submitted to state legislatures on behalf of corporations. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Mike Smith, the protester who had his day in court today.
Talk about what happened in court today.
Well, got there this morning, was really excited, actually. I've been preparing to do this trial for almost a year now. I was arrested on February 29, or in the Occupy famous slang, F-29 of, last February, and held for about 8 hours. My charge, they first charged me with a felony, I guess, to try to scare me, kind of made me laugh because I knew they would drop it and throw it out because, to my recollection, I really didn't break anything or harm anything. My charge was felony criminal mischief, because they alleged that I climbed on top of a work van and cracked the front windshield. And got out of jail late in the evening of the day I was of my arrest, and then I was basically going back and forth to court sometimes once or twice a month, every month since last February. So it's been a really long trial.
Can you tell us what F-29 was about?
Oh, it was basically against the corporations, or specifically ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council. What ALEC is, basically a right-wing group that helps legislators write boilerplate manipulation of our laws. So that corporations can basically keep doing what they've been doing. So we systematically went through, it was a big march downtown, and did some political theater in front of various businesses around town, some banks, the Verizon store where I was arrested.
And what's the current status of Occupy Portland?
My feelings of it is it's kind of an amorphous, loose affiliation of thousands of people that all legitimately operate from the animus of wanting to bring something better into the world. So the status of Occupy is, well, we don't really have a physical space anymore because we've occupied more than that. We've occupied the hearts, minds, and imaginations of the American people. Occupy has succeeded in changing the dialogue. I mean, in 2008, I attended the anti-bailout protest here in Portland, and it was sad. It, you know, broke my heart. I'm a videographer, activist videographer, and I filmed it, and there was like 30 people. Now, you know, the idea of quantitative easing, the predatory lending practices perpetuated by these racist, malignant banks, you know, the idea of race, gender inequality are things that are talked about in most living rooms across the country, and that's because Occupy stood up. So that's kind of like the status of Occupy. We're still there. We're part of the political dialogue now. We're not going anywhere.
Okay, well, I think that does it for my questions. I'd like to thank you for your time and congratulate you on getting the case dismissed.
Well, thank you. It's great speaking with you.
Same here. You have a great day. We've been speaking with Mike Bluehair Smith of Occupy Portland on his court case being dismissed today. I'm Robin Ryan with KBOO News.
A recent ruling from the Eugene City Council allowed the use of tents on city property as an expression of free speech. The new measure is a response to a statewide camping ban, which makes it illegal to erect a structure meant for sleeping except for recreational purposes. Protesters were jubilant at the victory for homeless rights and vowed to keep up the fight for homeless citizens. Today, Zoe White spoke with Ibrahim Mubarak, an activist who works primarily with Right to Dream 2 in Portland and acts as a liaison to a sister organization in Eugene called Sleeps.
When did the protesting begin in Eugene?
Protesting was always in Eugene, but it became more popular during the occupation movement. And as usual, when all different groups rise up, you have your houseless community there. And so as people come and go, the houseless people had nowhere to go. So they kept pursuing the matter on having a safe place to sleep with their partners or family members. It is a need for more shelter and affordable housing for low to no income. And so if you're the public and the city land is public, you have a right to protest. You have a right to free speech. And that's in our Constitution.
Now, Eugene had initially said that that wasn't a right that people had. What made them change their heart?
Well, a group of us from Portland, from Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2, went and talked to the city officials, and we let them know on what we're doing here, and we educated the people in Eugene and the city official per se about our rights and stuff. And so I don't know if that was the key factor when we went there and talked to them, but they have been coming here with us and we've been consulting them on the way we do things. And since I'm one of the co-founders of Digny Village, they was more in tune to listen to the type of concept I had and the things we did.
Does the language of the law in Eugene specifically allow houseless people to camp on city grounds for their own survival needs or for specifically political reasons?
Well, you know, in Oregon, in the whole state of Oregon, it's a camping ban. So to defeat that camping ban, we told them to use, like we call it, a rest area. They just have places where people come rest. It's not a campsite. And so in Oregon, they have things against camping unless it's recreational camping, and you have to go through all the rigmarole on getting censored and sponsored and meet the coding and the zoning laws. And it should be, and they call camping anything when you eradicate a structure like a shopping cart and a tarp over you to stay out the rain and stuff. And I think that's against your human rights.
Does the Sleeps organization want to file a lawsuit against the city for denying people the right to protest for the time that they did?
We sued the city and the Bureau for Development Service for calling and finding us and zoning us to something what we're not, because they couldn't agree to what we're doing. So if you're going to protest and stand out there, you have a right to protest. I mean, that's in your constitutional right. That's in the law. That's in the Bill of Rights. That's in the amendment. That's what gives this country the freedom.
All right. And finally, does the Sleeps organization help to find people housing or jobs or place people in training programs should they want that?
Well, that's something that we all want to do, and all we can do is be a resource reference because we don't have those capabilities, I'd say, ourselves. But if we can refer people to different things and different avenues, that we're willing to work with groups and organizations and even employers that's looking for employees that's been
And that was housing activist Ibrahim Mubarak speaking with KBOO's Zoe White about the Eugene City Council's decision to allow camping on public property in the city of Eugene. Last night, the Olympia City Council banned camping on city property. Council member Jim Cooper voted against the ordinance in early December, but was not present for Tuesday night's vote. Although city property includes Olympia's famous artesian wells and various small parks, the ordinance was written primarily to stop homeless camping in front of City Hall. City manager Steve Hall said conditions outside the building have been unsafe and unsanitary. The ordinance, which passed unanimously, will take effect on February 8th. The same bill also includes new regulations preventing sitting or lying on sidewalks between midnight and 7 a.m. The new sidewalk laws, which eliminate restrictions for street performers and sandwich signs, will take effect on February 18th. Portland Commissioner Nick Fish yesterday announced that landlords will face undercover testing for discrimination this year. The Portland Housing Bureau will hire a Washington company to oversee testing by the Fair Housing Council of Oregon under a new $70,000 deal. The Fair Housing Council tested landlords in 2010. This led to a report stating that about two-thirds of African-American and Latino testers received different treatment than white testers in the rental market. Outside analysts found that major flaws were present in the testing program and that no landlords were punished. Commissioner Fish said that the new testing method will produce usable results this time. The test will be supervised by the Fair Housing Center of Washington. Fish says that this oversight and leadership changes at the Housing Council increases the legitimacy of this project. After landlords are flagged for being discriminatory, the city will order follow-up tests and refer cases to the Oregon Department of Justice for enforcement. Portland Ombudsman Margie Solinger announced today that the city agreed to a $17,000 settlement with a contractor who billed the city for services it never provided. Portland's fraud hotline received a call in June that accused Cable Mercer Group of accepting payment for work on Portland's Sheltered Market Program in 2006. The Sheltered Market Program offers support to minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses. Solinger turned her preliminary investigation into the Portland Police Bureau's White Collar Crime Unit, but Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney Dennis Shen withdrew the case last year, which means that Cable Mercer Group will not face criminal repercussions. Solinger says that she will use this opportunity to review Portland's contracting practices. City Auditor LaVon Griffin-Vallad wrote in 2010 that the Sheltered Market Program was in need of clearer focus and stronger management. The Oregon State Legislature will convene briefly next week to swear in legislators and to meet with constituents. The full session will begin on February 6th in Salem. One of the things on the docket this session is funding for the Columbia River Crossing Bridge between Portland and Vancouver. The federal government has not agreed to provide its portion of the funding for the bridge, but the state legislature is still on track to approve $450 million of state funds. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sharon Nassett, who is helping to organize a day of action next Tuesday in Salem to oppose the Columbia River Crossing Project.
I wonder if you could talk about the action planned in Salem on January 15th.
I would love to. You know, the legislators, our Oregon legislators, are getting ready to fund the Columbia River Crossing, even though it's going to steal all this money from our region and we really don't know what's being constructed. They are talking about spending our state money, and I'm not talking about just the tolls, but $450 million. And it's really important for people to come down to Salem and walk around to the different legislators and just tell them why CRC isn't what we need, the Columbia River Crossing.
And I understand there have been some problems with the project so far, including the engineer is planning to construct it at the wrong height for boats to get through.
Yes, and it's mostly arrogance. They knew that they were building a bridge that was at 95 feet 3 months out of the year. The rest of the year it's less than, and that the Coast Guard had told them they use all the way up to 179 feet now, and not to lower it. But it's not their first major mistake. As you probably remember, the first bridge called the Mega Bridge had this huge black tunnel for people to ride their bikes in, and they couldn't even see the water. And it was called that it would just be just as like people would live there, and the police said it wouldn't work. Then the next bridge they constructed was so poorly engineered that engineers from around the world came and said that it couldn't stand on its own, and it was so poorly engineered, they couldn't even fix it and recommended them starting again.
What consideration have Oregon and Washington officials given to alternative bridge proposals?
Well, they haven't. The problem has been is that the Columbia River Crossing and the Oregon Transportation Department, which is should feel very unpleased with itself, has been making continual false statements. Our project, the third bridge, was not studied. There are about six projects that weren't studied, but ours was not studied. And we have letters from Clark County commissioners, wasn't studied. We have letters from the Regional Transportation Council in Washington that it wasn't studied. And CRC has come back to the Oversight Committee and made false statements that it was. Clark County commissioners, as a board, sent back a statement and said if they're implying that this was even vetted, considered, that they're making false statements.
So we've had misrepresentations of the project, both the level of funding and the way that the project is being carried forward. What are you specifically asking Oregon state legislators to do in this upcoming session?
What we are asking the Oregon legislators to do is not take our state funds and give them a $450 million, yes, go right ahead. What we would like is for them to have a supplemental environmental impact statement. Very common to do it in a project of this size. It's uncommon not to have one. And this supplement should include buses, because that's what Clark County wants for their transit. So we would like the legislators to say no funding on the Columbia River crossing until after a supplement has been done with new vendors, new contractors, and none of the same transportation employees involved. It's next Tuesday, January 15th, which is Martin Luther King Jr.'s actual birthday. It is on the Capitol steps in Salem, starting at 8 a.m. in the morning. For those that would like to come early, the main amount of people will come between 10 and 3, but from 8 to 5.
Again, I've been speaking with Sharon Nassett, an organizer with Third Bridge Now. Their website, thirdbridgenow.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Oregon Senator Chip Shields has proposed legislation that would give consumer groups access to proprietary information from Blue Cross Blue Shield Insurance Company. This will allow the groups to review the impact of potential rate increases before those increases are put in place. A consumer advocate with the Oregon Public Interest Research Group says that there is currently no independent check on whether information being withheld from the public should be withheld. Healthcare companies, including Regence and HealthNet, have worked to keep information on rate increases secret, saying that the information was proprietary. This was despite the fact that the proposed rate increases would severely impact hundreds of thousands of Oregonians. The new legislation would also give the state attorney general the ability to sue insurance companies that engage in fraud and blatant consumer abuses. Insurance is the only line of business that is exempt from the state's Unfair Trade Practices Act.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Right to Survive at 6. And at 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. On tonight's show, a panel will discuss the new Quentin Tarantino movie Django Unchained and its depiction of the black community. Also, Dave Zirin will speak about the lack of inductions into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Tomorrow's weather is rain, turning to snow, possibly by the afternoon, with highs in the low 40s.
It's 5:19 in the post-meridian. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Good news, America. At last, scientists are grappling with a persistent affliction that can strike without warning, causing anxiety for millions of families every year. It's the tragedy of needle drop. No, not drug injection needles. Christmas tree needles. Each December, you search out the finest and freshest conifer, pay good money for it, give it water and love, decorate it beautifully, and how does it repay you? Within 2 to 4 weeks, the ingrate is shedding needles all over your carpet. It's the scourge of Christmas, I tell you. But take heart, for your tax-funded land-grant colleges are on the way to rescue you and all other needle drop sufferers. Specifically, plant pathologists at Washington State University, North Carolina State, and elsewhere have mounted a $1.3 million RNA sequencing trial. They're sampling branches from thousands of trees in search of that one nucleotide polymorphism that controls needle drop. This heroic mission requires remarkable attention to detail. For example, in Puyallup, Washington, a research specialist lifts each of several thousand sample branches in her lab one by one, rubs her fingers up and down each stem, then counts the needles that fall from each one. Another specialist enters the number into an ever-spreading spreadsheet. It's a tedious job, but someone has to do it. Or not. Really, of all the problems facing American consumers and agriculture, should Christmas needle retention be this high on our list of research priorities? Well, responds the chief needle drop pathologist at Washington State, the Christmas tree industry is a $1 billion industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly. So let this profitable industry pay for its own research, rather than diverting our tax funds and government scientists from more important work that will produce much greater public benefit.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, 10 major U.S. banks settled with the government over accusations that they had made fraudulent loans and illegal evictions. The settlement totaled almost $19 billion, some of which will go to those affected by the loans, and some of which will go to the United States government. Many consumer advocates are upset with the settlement, saying it's not nearly enough to compensate for the damage done. Earlier today, KBOO's Rob Shyrock spoke with Pratap Chatterjee of CorpWatch about the settlement.
First question, can you describe the settlements reached this week between the federal government and 10 major U.S. banks?
So, the important thing to understand about this is that there were an estimated 3.8 million people that got bad loans that basically are in deep trouble because their houses aren't there, their mortgages are underwater. And the federal government, in stepping into this mess, basically said they wanted to figure out a way to make sure that these people would not, you know, lose their homes. So they created something in 2011 called the Independent Foreclosure Review. And that was a program by which the banks were going to look into these 3.8 million bad loans and figure out who had actually been given a bad deal and compensate them somehow. Now, the problem with this was it was run by the banks. Even though it was called the Independent Foreclosure Review, it was run by the bank's own consultants. And these guys were charging a lot of money, $250 an hour for 20 hours. So in each case, they were charging like $5,000. They spent $1.5 billion. And they looked at less than 10% of the people that were eligible actually applied, because most people were deeply skeptical. And at the end of the control of the currency basically said, look, this is not working. This is extremely expensive. Nobody's been compensated, and we need to figure out another way. So they came to a settlement with the banks by which the banks paid out this total of $8.5 billion. But really, in my opinion, this is pennies on the dollar, because the average person is going to get about $2,000, right? And, you know, some of these people have been evicted from their homes. The banks, on the other hand, get to walk away from this. Once they sign the settlement, it means they're off the hook. And these are banks that are doing very well, thank you very much. As David Lazarus pointed out in the Los Angeles Times, you know, Citigroup made $11.3 billion in profit in 2011. J.P. Morgan Chase made $19 billion in profit. Wells Fargo, $16 billion. And Bank of America, $1.4 billion. So these people are not hurting. They can definitely make whole these people who were evicted from their homes, to whom they should never have given expensive or untenable mortgages in the first place.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, what do you think would have been a more appropriate response by the federal government to the mortgage fraud?
Well, our problem here is the Obama administration. The Obama administration has not basically dealt in a firm or strong way with the banks. They have not attempted to really do anything about the individuals and the institutions that that have treated people out of their savings and been kicked out of their homes. And this is unfortunately the way they conduct business. And whereas there are some people and some individuals within the government, and for example, the U.S. attorney, you know, in New York, who really made an effort to identify and go after the banks that had caused the problem, what's basically happening is the administration is now basically foreclosing on this lawsuit in some ways, because they could actually be doing a better job for the people. So the banks, of course, are a problem, but the government has not helped, and the government has not acted in a way, you know, that is responsible or representative of the people.
I've been speaking with Pratap Chatterjee, Executive Director of the blog CorpWatch. This is Rob Shryock with KBOO News, Portland.
A military judge pushed back the trial of Bradley Manning until June to allow extra time to deal with classified material. Manning had been due to stand trial for 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, for which Manning can receive a life sentence in military custody with no chance of parole. Manning is accused of being responsible for WikiLeaks' publishing of state secrets. The judge, Colonel Denise Lind, reduced Manning's sentence by 112 days because of his harsh treatment in military detention. Manning was held without trial or charge at Quantico Marine Base in Virginia from July 29, 2010 to April 20, 2011. The reduced sentence is a victory for Manning's defense team, which contends that the Army singled out Manning for harsh treatment. Manning claims he will plead guilty to lesser charges in exchange for a reduced sentence.
Yesterday, a federal judge sentenced Francis Schaefer Cox, the founder and leader of the Alaska Peacemakers Militia, to 26 years in prison. Last June, an Alaskan jury convicted Cox on 9 federal charges, including conspiracy to assassinate judges and other government employees. Cox founded several anti-government groups in Alaska, including the Second Amendment Task Force and the Liberty Bell Network. A follower of Cox received the same sentence on Monday for conspiracy to murder and weapons charges. Cox received a new trial attorney following his conviction, who crafted a defense based on a post-trial mental evaluation that found that Cox suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. This defense contradicted Cox's behavior during his trial, however, when he defended his political philosophy and compared himself to political leaders such as the Reverend Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Before running afoul of the federal government, Francis Schaefer Cox ran to represent Alaska's 7th District in Congress, earning nearly 40% of the vote during the Republican primaries.
Vice President Biden announced today that the president could take executive action regarding gun control legislation. The vice president is due to meet with the NRA, gun owner groups, and retailers such as Walmart in an effort to discuss gun control legislation at the White House tomorrow. Biden was asked to construct a committee to review gun control after the attack that killed over 20 elementary students in Connecticut last month. Some topics to be discussed in the meeting will include making gun trafficking illegal, prosecuting individuals caught lying on gun background check forms, and ordering federal agencies to send data to the National Background Check Database. While changes like these can be made through executive action, others, such as bans on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines, require congressional approval, which may prove to be more difficult. In 2004, under pressure from the NRA, Congress let a similar ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines expire. As the discussion continues, President Obama is expected to announce his administration's plans in regard to gun control after the inauguration on January 21st.
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont announced today that he will reintroduce legislation to prohibit financial executives from becoming directors on the Federal Reserve Board. The only socialist senator in the U.S. Congress made his announcement just 10 days after the end of Jamie Dimon's second term as director of the New York Fed. According to the Government Accountability Office, Diamond, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, was among at least 18 current and former directors of Federal Reserve banks who received $4 trillion in near-zero interest Federal Reserve loans after the 2008 financial collapse. Diamond's bank alone received nearly $400 billion in low-interest loans as part of the Fed bailout program. Bernie Sanders has tried several times to eliminate such conflicts of interest in the Federal Reserve. Here's a clip of Senator Sanders speaking on the Senate floor last August.
The Fed is the institution, maybe the most powerful agency of the United States government. And their job, among other things, is to regulate Wall Street. Well, the truth of the matter is, it is people from the huge financial institutions who sit on the Fed boards that are regulating themselves. That may make sense to somebody, Dylan, but it doesn't make sense to me. And what the report documents that in a number of instances, people who sit on these Fed boards and also are high-ranking officials at financial institutions have been able to get programs and financial assistance from the Fed to their own financial institutions. That is, to my mind, a real conflict of interest. I think what we have to say now is enough is enough. Now, from my perspective, having offered this provision that got us this information, this is just the beginning. What I intend to be doing is working with economists and the general public to begin sitting down and say, what kind of structure should we have on the Fed so that it reflects the needs of ordinary Americans and not just a Wall Street and the big financial institutions.
That was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on the need to reform the Federal Reserve Bank.
A defense contractor in Virginia settled a lawsuit brought by 71 former inmates held at Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities in Iraq from 2003 to 2007 for $5.3 million. Some inmates have said they were raped, beaten, and left naked for extended periods of time. The case marks the first successful lawsuit brought against a military contractor. L3 Services, who provided 6,000 translators to the U.S. military in 2006 under a $450 million contract, is now a subsidiary of Angility Holdings Incorporated of Chantilly, Virginia.